The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Frank Wilson. I used to be the book editor of The Enquirer. You remember The Enquirer, I hope. Good writing is like a person's signature. It can't be mistaken for anybody else's. Nobody's going to take Chekhov for Dostoevsky or Graham Greene for Evelyn Waugh. Read any page of any good writer, and right away you know exactly where you are and who you're with. Case in point. They put Foley and the Cuban together in the back seat of the van and took them from the Palm Beach County Jail on Gun Club to Glades Correctional, the old red brick prison at the south end of Lake Okeechobee. That sentence, which happens to be the first one in Road Dogs, will signal to any reader who's been there before that he is once again entering Elmore Land, a region whose inhabitants speak a language not taught in the schools, American. Once you find yourself in Elmore Land, you also find yourself hanging on those inhabitants' every word. You just can't help noticing that what they say and the way they say it is smooth and tangy, like good bourbon. These are people who say things like, "I'm an ordained minister of the Spiritualist Assembly of Waco, Texas, but I started out doing nails." When you come upon a sentence like that, you know that language, when it's alive, packs a wallop. And you don't have to take my word for any of this, because the man who discovered Elmore Land and has been exploring its environs low these many years is with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, a nice welcome for Elmore Leonard.
Thank you. This book puts together three of my favorite characters. Jack Foley from Out of Sight, which played by George Clooney. And I had no trouble picturing him in this book as I was writing it. He fit right in. And then also Kundo Ray, who was in La Brava in the early 80s. But I wasn't sure if he was alive. So I had to look through La Brava, and I come to the scene where Joe La Brava shoots him in the chest three times. But he has to leave quickly for some reason, I don't know. So no one says he's dead. So a couple of emergency guys find he's still breathing, and so they take him to the hospital, and he's in a coma for 60 days. Actually, he's faking the coma while he looks around and find out what's going on, you see. Well, then he eventually goes to California in Venice, buys property in Venice at the right time, and makes a lot of money. Then he's convicted, and he's in prison. He's convicted of second-degree murder, and he's in prison at the same time as Foley. So this was my opportunity to get a couple of characters that I thought needed a little bit more time on the page. They put Foley and the Cuban together in the back seat of the van and took them from the Palm Beach County Jail on Gun Club to Glades Correctional, the old red brick prison at the south end of Lake Okeechobee. Neither one said a word during the ride. It took most of an hour, both of them handcuffed and shackled. They were returning Jack Foley to do his 30 years after busting out for a week, Foley's mind on a woman who made intense love to him one night in Detroit, pulled a Sig Sauer 38 the next night, shot him, and sent him back to Florida. The Cuban, a little guy about 50 with dyed hair pulled back in a ponytail, was being transferred to Glades from the state prison at Stark, 5 years down, 2.5 to go, of a second-degree murder conviction. The Cuban was thinking about a woman he believed he loved, this woman who could read minds. then when he's in prison, Dawn is his, he looks on her as his common-law wife. They almost got married in Las Vegas, but didn't bother. So he's in prison, and he said, He calls her, the first year of prison, he called her regularly, every week, and he'd say to her, "Are you being a saint?" Dawn would say, "Of course I am." Or she would vary the answer and say, "Aren't you my love?" Or sometimes, "Aren't you my undying love?" Kundo believes saints never got laid. So he'd say, "You swear to Almighty God you being a saint for me?" "I swear to God I'm being a saint." "For me?" "Yes, for you. I want to hear you say it so I believe it." After several months of this, Dawn began to say, without raising her voice or showing any strain, "How many times do I have to tell you, yes, I'm being a saint for you? Your tone of voice doesn't convince me, because you make me say it over and over and over." Now there was a hint of strain. "Will you please stop asking me if I'm being a saint?" One day, still during Kundo's first year inside, Dawn said, "If you ask me that again, I swear I'll hang up the phone. I won't be here the next time you call. I'll vanish, and you'll never hear my voice again as long as you live. If you don't believe me, ask if I'm being a saint. I fucking dare you." He believed her. So, let's see. So she's living in one of the homes in Venice on a canal, and right across from her, Kundo sends Foley to live there, and he'll be out in just a few weeks later. And he said, "Keep an eye on Dawn for me, will you?" And yet he's practically offering Foley to her. So Dawn comes over to visit him finally. And she says, "I'll come over," Dawn said. "I haven't been across the bridge in weeks." She said, "Are all the pictures of me still up?" Kundo made me swear I wouldn't touch them. "You know, I lived there almost a month but had to move. Everywhere I looked, I saw myself, and I never changed, the blonde with exotic eyes. So I moved to the pink house. It's terracotta, but Kundo says it's pink, and he's too macho to live in a pink house." She said, "We could meet now if you want. It isn't too early, is it? I love to sip Jack Daniels in the morning." Foley said, "You sure that's what I have? And Mexican beer, but I like the sour mash." "You must be psychic," Foley said, "or you've been going through my trash." "Oh, I saw you shopping at Ralph's. And I thought, why, this must be Jack Foley trying not to look furtive. A former inmate in the world again. I got that from your body language, Jack. What I learned about you took place your first night here, getting smashed on Puerto Rican rum till you went to sleep. I thought, well, that's done. He celebrated his release, spent a day hungover, and now he'll call. I know you've been dying for us to meet, but had to settle in first. You're still uneasy being out in public, going to stores." She said, "Let's see if I can get you feeling like yourself again." And Foley said, "I always feel like myself." "You think you do. I'll be over," Dawn said. "Let's see, about 12:30. You need an hour to comb your hair? I want to bathe and look nice for you. This is a big day for us." Well, she comes over and they have drinks up in a bedroom where a big nude painting of her is on the wall. Then they start talking about her, the fact that she's kind of an ordained psychic, if there is such a term. And Foley says to her as they're sitting there talking, "You ever use hypnosis?" "Now and then. Would you like to be hypnotized?" "It doesn't work on me. Will you let me try?" "I know it won't work." And I remember when I was writing that, I thought, is it going to work or not? How do I want him to react to this? He says, "I know it won't work. Close your eyes, Jack. Not too tight. Let your breath out slowly. That's it. I'll count down from three. All right? We'll take our time. Three, Jack. Your muscles are relaxing. Your whole body is going limp. Two, you feel safe with me. You know you can say whatever you want. Dawn paused. And one, are we ready, Jack? She reached for his hand on the table and pinched his skin. Jack, what? Did I hurt your hand? No. You willing to talk to me, yes or no? Yes. You'll let me take you back to the prison where you knew Kundo Ray? Yes or no? Yes. Is Kundo Ray a friend of yours? Yes or no? Yes. Do you trust him? Dawn waited. No. Now she paused. Would you say he's worth a lot of money, Jack? Yes or no? Yes. In properties, Dawn said, and a partner in Little Jimmy's investment service. Did you know that? No. Did you know Little Jimmy runs a sports book for him? No. You know if Kundo has bank accounts? Foley hesitated again, and Dawn said, let's skip that one. Do you think he has money the IRS doesn't know about, money he's never declared as income? Foley turned his head, resting against soft red leather, to open his eyes and look at Dawn. He said, I think he's got a shitload of money that's never been close to being declared. What do you think? She smiled, shaking her head, Foley grinning at her, Foley saying, are we getting to it now? Dawn said to her neighbor, the bank robber in his clean white T-shirt, his hair parted and combed, well, aren't you the tricky motherfucker? I'll have to watch my step with you, won't I? So, and naturally, I remember when I wrote it, I sent in the first 100 pages or so to my editor. And she says, I think you're moving them together a little too fast. I said, no, they won't have time. I mean, if I delay, it won't work. So you can imagine then the rest of the scene. So I had a good time writing it, and because George Clooney played that part before, we sent it to him. But he hasn't read it yet. This was last February, and he hasn't read it. And I can understand why does he want to read, of all things? I mean, when there's so much to do in Hollywood. You know. But I've been writing for 58 years. My first sale was in 1951, and I've developed a style over the years. John D. MacDonald said you have to write a million words before you know what you're doing, before you can feel confident of your prose style. And I think he's pretty close there, though you can come up with a blockbuster with your first book, but it isn't likely to happen. And so I've had such a good time writing that I can't imagine doing anything else. I left the ad agency in 61. I was there for 7 years and got back into writing. Well, first I had to do some freelance work, and I did a lot of movies, histories and geographies for Encyclopedia Britannica Films. There were things like Settlement of the Mississippi Valley, and Rome, Boy of Rome, and the Danube, French and Indian War. So I wrote about a dozen of them, and started to learn how to write movies. I've written a lot of movies. I've sold at least 20 properties to Hollywood, and some are still just sitting there. They were bought and then decided they didn't want to do it. So that happens. But they're owned by a studio. So they're hard to get to try somebody else. Which is happening right now. My granddaughter, who's been in Hollywood about 8 years, she produced a short story of mine, which was called Sparks, about a woman who burns down her house in the Malibu Hills, because she doesn't like the furniture. And the furniture belonged to her late husband's first wife. But it's all Chinese, and she doesn't like living among this stuff. So then I forgot who was in the movie, in the short. It was 20, 25 minutes. And the insurance investigator comes to see her. She's Carla Gugino, if you know who that is. And the investigator is a name actor, and I can't think of... I keep... Every year, I forget more and more actors' names. So... But it was good. It was really good. And they showed it at, what's the one, Redford's?
Sundance.
Thanks. It was on the tip of my tongue. And it didn't win, but it was well received. And so I've had a lot of luck selling to Hollywood. 310 to Yuma, which came out again last year, first appeared in 56 or 7, and with Glenn Ford, Van Heflin. And even that one was different than my shorts, a little different at the very end, than my short story that I sold a Dime Western for $90. But then I sold the film rights for $4,000, which was a steal. So then... Then they even made it again, but I didn't get anything for that. So the second one I thought was visually great all the way up to the very end. And then the end, I didn't understand at all what was going on. Evidently, you didn't either. Because he shoots his own men who are left, and then he gets on the train to Yuma Penitentiary. And then whistles for his horse. I don't know what that means. So, I'm writing a book now. And I'll tell you the name of it. Djibouti. Djibouti is a city in a small country called Djibouti, which was a French Foreign Legion post for probably over 100 years. And they're still there. And Djibouti is at the mouth, at the southern end of the Red Sea that comes down from the canal from the Mediterranean. So it's down here. And then it's the Gulf of Aden, and then the Indian Ocean. And the pirates now are all operating in the Gulf of Aden. And they're making a fortune. They've probably made $50 million. So far, in ransoms, they say we're not committing a crime. We're fining these ships for throwing waste in our waters, and toxic waste they claim has been dumped there, and then other fishing companies have come in and taken over their means of livelihood. So they decided to. Find them. So a woman by the name of Dara Barr, who's a documentary filmmaker, decides that she wants to do a picture about the Somali pirates because she sympathizes with them. And the few articles she would read were about these guys, these fun-loving guys who go out and climb on a ship with AK-47s, never, ever shoot anybody, and then wait to make a deal while one of their men makes a deal with the shipping company. And they wanted $25 million, for example, for the Sirius Star, which is a 1,000-foot oil tanker with $3 million worth of oil aboard. But they waited 4 months and then settled for $3 million. Which was still profit, because what did they expend at all? You know, they just waited around. So they're doing great. So I have Dara Barr. She takes off from France and lands in Djibouti, one flight a week. And she meets that night one of the pirates who is driven up in his Mercedes from his base along the Indian Ocean, and he's a fun-loving guy. You know, he's a lot of fun, and And he boasts a lot, but so what? He's a pirate, you know. She accepts that. Then she meets another guy from he's Saudi, and his name is Ari, A-R-I, but everyone started calling, he went to Oxford, and they called him Harry there. So he's Harry, and he plays the English Arab, you know, but he doesn't overdo it. He's pretty good at it, and he's a good-looking guy. And so I've got these two guys. Then I've got a guy on a boat, you know, $2 million sailboat. It's $2 million because it's equipped with everything. But he's a billionaire, and he has a girl with him. This girl has passed the 48-hour test. She never used I when she should have used me, and didn't talk slowly trying to think of the right word all the time. You know, she was an easygoing girl, and he liked her a lot. She was a runway model, and he met her in Paris. And he's going to take her around the world. And if she doesn't complain, get bored, or throw up, he may marry her. And there are times when she wanted to stick her finger down her throat, you know. But she toughs it out. She talks to Dara. There are several scenes with Dara when she tells him, you know, what her plight is. God, I mean, this is bad. Not only to have to ride on that boat all the time, but this guy is boring. He never says anything that's interesting. He makes speeches. Well, but he has a double-barreled rifle that fires a cartridge of 600 caliber cartridge, so that when the pirates are coming out to him, and then they circle like Indians and ride past him, he blows the engines right off the rear end. And I mean, that's just a scene, and I'm 138 pages into it, and we stopped for the book tour. And I'm anxious to get back to it. And I know what's going to happen for about the next 60 pages. And then I'll have to think of what happens next. But that's the fun of it. I don't want to know because, you know, 30 years ago I used to outline my books. I'd outline the whole thing. It'd take me a week. And then as I'm writing it over 4 to 6 months, I think of much better ideas. So I don't outline. But I have an idea. I'm thinking of people and what they will lead the story to, because it's motivated. The plot's motivated by my characters. There isn't something like they're going to look for a great stone, you know, a diamond or something. There's not that much direction at first. You wonder what's going to happen. That's the idea. But you know, my readers know everything. They know as much as the main character. And then they know what the bad guys are up to, usually. So there's never a mystery. And when a critic says, well, I knew how it was going to end before I got there. Well, I didn't. And I'm sure a lot of people did, but that's not my purpose. So, how about questions? Ah, good.
Raise your hands, we'll get a microphone to you. Paul, if you could turn this on. Okay, right here in front, please.
Do you know your characters? Are they people that you've met? Are they compilations of people, or are they in your brain?
No, I make them up. I make them all up. But most of them are a certain type of person, you know. But I like them all. I have an affection for all of my characters, even the bad guys, because they're so dumb.
Can I follow up with you? Do you know the bad guys? I mean, have you been involved with the prison system at all? Do you know?
I get letters from convicts. I haven't in a little while, but I get letters, and usually you know it's from a guy who is in on a dope charge because he's literate. He can write the letter. You know, he didn't do anything with a gun. And he'll talk about how his fellow inmates, who they like, you know, and they liked all the usual writers. I mean, the ones who sell a lot of books are at the top of the Times list. I'm not talking about good writing. I'm talking about popular, very popular novels. And he says that's what most of them read. And he says, I have to talk them into reading you. But what I'd like to know is where did you get your knowledge of convict life? Have you ever done time? And I said, no, I haven't done time, but you can read enough about prisons. You can read enough about an article that focuses on a particular aspect of prison life, and in it people talk, convicts talk. And I've been to prisons. I went to Angola in Louisiana, which at one time was a very, very tough prison, and university. The prison in Tennessee, I think they moved it since I was there. But I talked to a writer's group there. And they were all polite and interested in, you know, how do you write a book? Or how do you write a short story? And they were as attentive as any group I've ever spoken to. And I've been to the Detroit city jail, Wayne County jail. And I've talked to people. But I think as far as the research is concerned, I spent a month with Squad 7 of the Homicide Section of the Detroit Police and did a piece. It's the kind of piece a journalist would spend 3 days with and then spend another day writing it. I spent over a month with them, and then I just started to write it. And finally, I mean, it took at least a month. And then after I wrote the piece, and it was the in the Roto section of the Detroit Free Press, big picture of a P-38 automatic and a tag on it that said Impressions of Murder. No, it said it across the bottom, but that was my title. And then I went back, spent more time with them because they were good guys and they were funny. And they would take me to investigations where homicide took place. They would take me to at the time of making an arrest. So I saw everything. And then made a lot of notes, of course. They let me look through their files, see everything. And that was it. Then, when they're in another book, I go back to see what's current. What are you working on now? Because they're working on, you know, maybe a dozen homicides at one time. And, you know, they'll give preference maybe to one and work harder on it. But this is good stuff. You hear the guy come in with the report from the medical examiner's office. And you hear exactly what he's saying, which I can't describe to you. I forgot. So it was great. It wasn't, you know, I just used their methods and so on and a lot of their dialogue. But I didn't I don't think I used any of their particular homicide cases. But this was perfect to throw in when you're working on a homicide in this book. Then you know, you can't get a better research than that. I do have a researcher who works for me full time, He lives in L.A., and he contacts me every day, and now he's working on the Djibouti. He's working on the pirates, and I get a stack of faxes every day. I don't have email. Once someone said, well, more than once, someone said, I'll email it to you. What's your email number? And I said, I don't have email. And he said, God, are you lucky? And why does he have it? Well, I suppose he has to have it.
Another question?
I don't have to have it. And I don't have to have call waiting or any voices that come on. I have enough trouble with the phone in a hotel room with all the buttons. Well, next question.
Right here in front.
Elmore, when you're involved in a writing project, what kind of schedule do you follow? How do you discipline yourself? Do you write in the mornings? Do you break for lunch? Do you write X number of hours a day? How do you schedule yourself through a project like that?
I used to work from 9 to 6 and skip lunch, just have some peanuts or something, because the time flew by. I thought, God, what a job this is. You look at the clock, it's 3:15, and say, good, I've got almost 3 more hours. That's the kind of job to have, you know? And so that... But when I was younger, I'd start at 9 and go to 6. And when I was working at an ad agency, I'd get up at 5 and work for 2 hours before getting ready to go to work. And in those 2 hours, I could write a page each hour because I didn't know any better. But I had to wait until I started to write before I put the water on for coffee. And I did that for almost 10 years. Well, say 8 years. And wrote 5 books and 30 short stories that sold. Next question.
3 rows back right here.
When you're making up your characters, what are you really looking for in the characters? I mean... They're very vivid in all your books, and so how do you sort of test them out? What's your judgment for whether to keep them or not?
I don't know. I start out with I want them to be human. I mean, I even want the bad guy to be human. I want to know, I'll see the guy who's getting ready to rob a bank. I mean, that day he's going to go rob a bank. And he gets out of bed, and he wonders what he's going to wear. You know, and maybe he looks in his closet a little bit. Because you know, because he's got several different motives in mind. Will he be remembered, or what will he feel really good in? You know? And that gives him a little touch of humanity, see? I don't know. I think I just make them up and they seem to work out. As you go along, you add a little bit of the personality, just a little bit. You don't stop the book and describe him physically and then say he's a nut or not or whatever. You know, you let that happen.
About 5 rows back right here.
Thank you. It's indeed an honor, sir, to address this question to you and welcome to Philadelphia. I'd like to say, with the roster of Hollywood giants who participate in a lot of your work, did you ever get an opportunity to cultivate any close relationships, like with Paul Newman, some of the distinguished actors? And can you have a moment to share some of those stories, if that did occur? Thank you.
My wife and I were approaching a clothing store on one of the streets in Beverly Hills. It was right near, on the corner of Little Santa Monica and this street. And we reached the door just as Paul Newman walked up. And I opened the door for Paul and my wife. And then we kind of hung around to see what he was going to buy. He bought a sweater for his wife. for his niece. Then he put on a jacket, and he looked at himself in the mirror, and he said, "Hey, this doesn't look bad." Paul Newman. I mean, it could have been in rags. And my wife kept saying, "Go tell him you wrote Ombre." And I said, "What if he didn't like it?" So I didn't approach him. I would have today, in a minute.
How about right over there in the corner? To your left. Yeah.
What writers do you enjoy reading?
I like Cormac McCarthy a lot. I like Pete Dexter. I like those fellows that were writing. Well, I like Dennis Lehane, especially after that nice blurb he gave me on the cover. No, but he's really good. He's good. And George Pelicanos. But my all-time favorite, going way back, I started with Hemingway and learned, I thought, a lot from Hemingway about being spare, showing restraint. But he didn't have a sense of humor. And I needed to see what kind of humor I could use. And I found Richard Bissell, who wrote 7½, which became The Pajama Game. And he was a pilot on the Mississippi River, and he wrote books set on the river, and those were my favorites. And I learned from him because his humor wasn't intentional. Everybody was just talking the way they talk, and it's funny to hear. An educated person to hear these guys who work on a towboat talking. And so that's why I liked him so much. Now there's a line, for example, I think one of his books opens with this guy standing at the window in a hotel room very early in the morning, and the woman on the bed rolls over and sees him at the window, and she says, "What in the world are you looking at?" And he says, "St. Louis, Missouri." Now, I think that's a terrific line, you know, and I don't know why. Well, I know it's Missouri that makes it work, but I love that sound. So,
let's keep going here. Why not? In the middle, in the red and white.
You are pretty much known for your great dialogue. Are you better at it now than you were, or what is it that is special about your dialogue?
Well, I try to make it sound normal, like this is the way people talk. This is the way people in this business, you know, whether they're bank robbers or the cops, this is the way they talk. This is what they say. And my mother said, "You shouldn't use that kind of language." And I try to explain to her, I'm not using it, I swear. But I read The Friends of Eddie Coyle, and I thought that's the best crime book ever written. I loved it. And my agent in Hollywood at that time told me, get the book and read it. And I feel it just loosened me up, and I began writing scenes, two people talking before describing where they are, or if they're on the phone, or what, you know? And I remember my producer at the time, publisher at the time, Don Fine, that would be one of his check marks. I want to know where they are. And I would tell him, "You'll find out in time." I'm not going to put it off too long.
We'll keep going. Gentleman in the gray.
Hi, Mr. Leonard. I was curious about how your personal life or where you are in your life affects your writing style. You know, if you're happy, if you're sad, how much influence that has, or if you're going through difficult times, how are you able to block that out and, you know, go through your story?
Well, I think I've had a great life. I lost a wife, but I got married again the same year. And I asked a friend of mine who did a cartoon 4 times a week for the Detroit Free Press. I said, you know, I'm very serious about Christine, but I don't know if I should get married again, and at least for a year. And he said, what are you, Sicilian? So we got married. No, I invited Christine to go on a sort of almost around the world book tour. We would end up in Australia after doing half of Canada and England. And I said, you want to go with me? And she said, what as? So we got married. And we've been married for 16 years, very happily.
I just keep laughing all the way in back there.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to speak with you, Mr. Leonard. I am a big, big, big Jackie Brown fan. Or Rum,
yeah,
a.k.a.
Good.
Rum Punch, of course. Good. Anyway, I'm a writer, singer, actress myself. What propels you? What makes you passionate about writing? And as a writer trying to eventually break out, could you tell me any tidbit of advice about getting published or self-publishing nowadays? Thank you.
The act of writing, I think, is the payoff, as far as I'm concerned, that you write a sentence that really works, and you love it. And it's not a show-off, but it says exactly what you want to say. I don't mean a sentence. Say more of a scene, a short scene, that some of it might even be quoted when the book's reviewed. So I just like the act of writing, and there's no reason for me to quit, because as I told you, I was writing in the morning before going to work. So, and finally that paid off. I probably wouldn't be here if I hadn't gotten up at 5 o'clock. I keep remembering that. I said, God, how did I do that? But I'm so glad I did. You've gotta just keep working at it. And I think the best thing to do if it's writing is to try and use your normal voice. Don't try and write. It's one of my rules. What is it? If it sounds like writing, rewrite it. And so what does that mean? Upon entering the room,
gentleman in back there.
I also like Jackie Brown and what Quentin Tarantino did with Rum Punch. I understand he's optioned Freaky Deaky. Has that been greenlit yet?
Freaky Deaky, he decided he wanted to do one more, which was Kill Shot, but he didn't do it, and he interfered with the casting. I don't think detrimentally, really, but enough. But the producer, Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, didn't like it from the beginning and gave John Madden, who was a good director from England, Shakespeare in Love, he had a time with him. He wasted a year. He wasted 2 years with Harvey, and finally they released the picture for 1 week in Phoenix, and that was it. Now it's DVD and so on. So it's too bad. Oh, so we wanted the rights. Oh, when it was time for the producer to make another payment for the rights of these books, and we said, look, instead of that, just give them back to us, because then we can market them other places, which we did. And I don't know how well we've done on that, but No, I don't remember. Anyway, we've got them, if anybody wants to buy one.
Right here in the white.
I used to be a classicist, and I was writing a paper on Homer once, and it was probably I was reading your sixth or seventh book that I'd ever read, and I said to myself, son of a bitch, the guy's got no similes in his prose. And your characters don't even use similes.
No.
When did you figure out that you didn't want to use similes in your prose, or is it just accidental?
That when I realized I'm not good at them. But I think they interrupt the story, especially the way, what's his name, with the crime writer, mystery writer. No, he's dead. Raymond Chandler, right, Raymond Chandler. You know, I thought his simile, this in any writing class, they'll bring out underline his similes, because that's writing. But I think it just gets in the way. I think it distracts from what's going on in the scene. But he's read probably for that reason, still read because of his language, because it was good. I didn't learn anything from him or from Hammett. I didn't learn much from most of the very popular writers.
Gentleman in the sweater over here.
I first discovered you when I read Stephen King's review of Glitz on the front page of the New York Times many years ago. And I was struck by the fact, even though I'm not a fan of Stephen King, but Stephen King said that you were his favorite writer. You already discussed the question about who you like, but do you ever write reviews? I mean, I've never seen any of your reviews of other writers, and what do you think of the state of reviews and criticism? It seems as though most reviews that I pick up are just synopses of what the books are and offer very little critical commentary.
Well, yeah, I think some reviews are learned and make sense, especially the good reviews that I get. And others, the reviewer is showing off. He's writing. He is a writer. So here he is writing, and he wants to entertain you at the same time. Where he might, the fact that it might be on the front of my book, our best crime writer or something, or the best one we've ever had, you know, right on the front cover of the book. And so many critics take exception to that. They'll name five guys. They'll use half the review naming people that they think are as good, if not better, you know. It's a terrible distraction, I think, for reviewers. I love Janet Maslin's reviews, which I got very, I just got a very good one. And they've all been pretty good. I've gotten a couple of bad ones. But you're supposed to not, when I remember back 20, 30 years ago when I got a bad review, boy, it would make me mad. I'd say, well, he didn't understand it. What? I don't know. Why is he, maybe there's an inaccuracy in his review, and I'd pick on that, but I don't do that anymore. You can dump all over my book, and I'll say, well, we'll still sell so many copies of it.
We've got to end it, and we're going to take this gentleman in the blue right here, if you'd wait for the mic.
Yeah, thanks. Huge fan for a long, long time, and I really would love to see Freaky Deaky on film. I was wondering, you'd mentioned earlier that you'd written a bunch of, or that you'd written screenplays, you know, documentary stuff long ago, and I know, you know, loads of your books have been made into movies, but I was wondering if you had written feature-length screenplays yourself, And if you could talk about the differences in writing screenplays as opposed to writing novels.
Well, I wrote one screenplay for Walter Mirisch that Charlie Bronson was in, Mr. Majestic. And that came out in, I think, 73 or 74, and I'm still getting residuals. 25 years later. But I didn't appreciate it. I didn't like to write screenplays because you're writing for somebody. You're writing for a studio executive or a producer. And you have, one time I sold one to TriStar, and I was in Hollywood, and I went to see them, and there were three of them sitting behind a table, and the guy in the middle said, "Well, all you did was adapt the book." And I thought that's what you were supposed to do. And leave as much of the book in as possible, at least any part of the book that's visual. But, and he said, "You know, if you just do that, why would we pay you just to do that, just to put it in a different format?" Well, I did write screenplays after that because I've liked movies all my life, and I thought I could do it. But I really never had a successful, good picture. And some have been really bad. You know, I thought The Big Bounce, I said when it came out, it's the second worst movie ever made. And then they made it again a few years ago, and it came in number one. So, and you wonder, I don't know how it happens, but I'm not in the movie business, so I don't write any more screenplays. In '93, I quit. I was asked by Bill Friedkin to give him an idea for a movie. So I told him one about how $3 million is sitting in a house in Florida, and sometime during the night, somebody's going to come and pick it up and then fly it here and there and fly it around the world and launder the money. It comes back. It's clean money. You can spend it any way you want. But burglar comes in and takes this ice chest full of money, and he's looking for a television set, and he runs out with all the money. So that's the plot, you know, who's he, what happens to him, and so on. And I said, my agent didn't want me to do, he wanted me to go home and write a book. And I said, look, Friedkin kept turning my ideas down because he didn't want Colombians and he didn't want drug money. Well, so I said, so my agent said, why don't you go home and write a book? And I said, no, I'm going to give it three more hours. So I was in Los Angeles. And this was the first day. So I went to bed, and I woke up at 5 o'clock. I think maybe the time change had something to do with it. Anyway, I woke up at 5 o'clock, and I thought, well, I'll think about it now. And in 5 minutes, I had the answer. A television evangelist who heals people and is making all kinds of money. And you see him, puts his hand on this little girl, and he says, say it, you know. He's rubbing her head, and she says, praise Jesus. And he's making all kinds of money. He drives home with one of the girls in the chorus, I mean the choir. Choir, and that night the burglar comes in and takes the money, and I wrote the screenplay, but I didn't really have my heart in it, and it's still sitting at Paramount. There's a big hole right in the middle of it. So, oh yeah, next question.
Well, I think we're done until Djibouti. Dutch Leonard.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.